Let the words of my mouth and the thoughts of our hearts now be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Imagine you own a car. Perhaps you do. Imagine it's an automatic. Perhaps it is. Imagine the dashboard with all those buttons and little screen that gives you messages. Perhaps the car talks to you. Imagine now you go into a charity shop and pick up an interesting looking book. Your car, how it works and how to look after it. So you buy it at a whatever nominal price the shop is asking for it, and you take it home and you turn its pages. Here's a page, what to do if the engine stalls. You are to get out the crank handle and insert it under the radiator and turn vigorously. Crank handle? What's that? And where do I put it if I got one? You turn to another page and it tells you how to signal when you're turning right or left or slowing down. You wind down the window. You put out your right hand with a straight arm for turning right. You make a circular movement for turning left. You wave it up and down if you're slowing down. Well, this time you're a little puzzled and you turn to the beginning of the book and then you notice that it was actually published in 1934. And so much has changed. And yet, you know, the principles are still the same. It's still an internal combustion engine and it runs on the same basic principles. You still need an accelerator to make it go faster, and you still need a brake to make it stop, and you still need a wheel to make it turn a corner. Indeed, you need four wheels to keep it on the road. The world has changed, and the instructions are out of date, but the principles behind them remain the same. Now, we have listened to a section from the Sermon on the Mount. The first thing you have to recognize is that we are looking at a different world. It is not the world of the 21st century, but the world in which Jesus lived. And so there's an awful lot that's different, but the principles remain the same. Part of the challenge to us is to sort out which are the details that belong to the time and which are the principles which still apply. Let me illustrate. Those words, when you are offering your gift at the altar and remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go first be reconciled and then come and offer your gift. Notice incidentally, if your brother or sister has something against you, not if you've got something against them, you are carrying the fault. Now, the setting of all that is the temple in Jerusalem. You come to make a personal sacrifice. You come because you want to offer a thanksgiving to God, or because the law requires you to come, as with Mary and Joseph bringing their newborn child to offer sacrifice, two turtle doves or two young pigeons, remember, as a thank offering. That's a personal act of worship. It's not congregational worship as we know it. And therefore you're free if you come to the altar and then suddenly remembered unreconciled conflict, to leave it there, go home, sort it out, and then come back. So, if you had a quarrel with your neighbour this morning, you don't have to walk out now. You can walk and sort it out when you get home. But the principle, you've got to sort it out if you want to be right with God. And especially if you're the one at fault. Or take that very difficult passage about divorce. I say to you, anyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of unchastity, in my version of the Bible, same thing. Anyone who divorces his wife causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now that's not the world of marriage as we know it. In our world, a couple fall in love, or think they have, and it's their choice. They get married. And then they discover that marriage is harder than they thought it was going to be. Or they discover they are so different that they're really incompatible to each other. Or both of them have hidden characteristics that come out only under pressure. A violent temper, perhaps, leading actually to physical abuse, or an addiction with alcohol or drugs. That's today's world and the underlying problems of divorce. The world Jesus knew was rather different, you see. These were arranged marriages. The woman was under the authority of her father until he handed her over to the authority of her husband. No women's rights here. And if the husband wanted to get rid of her, he could write out a certificate and send her back to father, who might then marry her off to someone else. She had no choice in the matter. The decision was with the man. Now, there were debates about the grounds on which the husband could write out this certificate. Was it just because he'd lost interest in her? Was it because he didn't like her face? Was it because she didn't cook well? Or was it only because she'd been unfaithful to him? And the teachers argued about the grounds of divorce. Notice, again, no issue about whether the husband is unfaithful to her. That's the world in which Jesus is speaking. That's the sort of marriage it was. So, like our car manual, we have to look behind the details at the underlying principles and ask ourselves, how do they apply today? And frankly, Christians have different, or not good conscience, have different views on the interpretation, the application of the principles that Jesus is speaking of. What is the foundation of a good marriage? What does justify bringing it to an end? As I say, we may in good Christian conscience have different views about the answers to those questions, but Jesus is clear about the principle underlying it all. Marriage is a serious commitment intended for life and not to be treated lightly. There's one other thing to keep in mind when you're listening to the teaching of Jesus, not just in this passage, but right the way through the Gospels. His sense of humour and his habit to exaggerate to make a point. And we tend to take him far too seriously. Let me illustrate from a passage outside the reading this morning. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Long-faced scholars and preachers have twisted and turned over that. It's impossible, it's absurd. You can't get a camel through the eye of a needle. It can't mean that. It must mean something else. It must be that he was thinking of a gate, in a small gate in the town gates, rather like those small doors in the gates of Cambridge colleges, where you might just about squeeze a camel through. Or maybe it's not a four-legged camel at all, but a thick rope called a camel, which might, won't go through a needle. It's all a waste of effort. Jesus meant us to laugh. He was deliberately being exaggerating. Of course a camel can't go through a needle, nor can a rich man go into heaven, clinging on to his riches. So, you have to look at the principles behind the teaching. And I suggest there are two. First, as you think about that passage we've listened to, don't just do the minimum. And secondly, do it from the heart. Here is a scene that has been played out in households throughout the country over many, many years. The family are going out. Mother calls, "John, are you ready?" Slight pause. John appears. "Here I am, Mum. Have you washed your face?" "I've wiped it with a flannel, Mum." "Have you cleaned your teeth?" "I cleaned them last night, Mum." "Have you combed your hair?" "I didn't think it needed it." "And look at your shoes, John." At which John rubs the back of his trouser leg with the toes of his shoes. "John, go back and do it properly." Trying to get away with the minimum is not confined to children. We all do it when we're in a hurry. What my mother used to call a cat's lick and a promise before you go out. And we all do the minimum when we're obliged to do something we don't actually want to do. How many of you have driven at 29 and a half miles an hour because the limit is 30? And you'll keep to it, but you're not going to keep that much to it. The religious world in which Jesus lived was based on observing rules. The Jews, you see, were conscious of the fact that God had chosen them to be a special people. And the response, as it were, the present to give back to God for this generosity, was to keep the commandments, all 613 of them in the first five books of the Bible. Yes, they counted them. And religious teachers would add to the list just to make sure. So, central to the religious life was to keep the commandments. But how easy for a religion of gratitude to degenerate into just keeping the rules. A tick box religion, where if you've done all the right things, you're okay. Think of the question the lawyer asked Jesus, "Who is my neighbour?" Why did he need to know? Because he didn't want to waste his efforts on people who weren't his neighbour. And Jesus blew a hole in that attitude by saying, "Your neighbour It's whoever is in need. The Good Samaritan responded, he was a neighbour to the man by the roadside. It's all a matter of going beyond just what we are required to do. Not a question of what do I have to do for God and my neighbour, but what more can I do for them? And so in today's lesson, it's not just a matter of not committing adultery, but going beyond that, not looking at anybody and wanting to commit adultery and wishing we could. It's not just a matter of not committing a murder, but not hating at all and not letting it spill over into raging anger or treating people with contempt, calling them a fool, because you feel they're beneath you. It's all summarized, isn't it, in that sentence that Jesus puts later on in the Sermon on the Mount that we'll come to in another Sunday's readings. What are you doing more than others? Not just the minimum. And the second principle, do it from the heart. That led me to think about the delicate balance between doing things because they are routine and doing them because our heart is in it. We need the routines, don't we? They keep us going when our heart isn't in something. But equally, the heart has to be in it if we are to keep up the routine. Think about worship on Sunday. I guess most of us, sometimes, maybe more often than not, have to make ourselves turn up. We don't look forward to it. There seem to be better things to do. Weather's bad, whatever. But if we only went when we felt like it, we'd feel like it less and less, and gradually drift away. And I guess many people have left church for that reason. They got out of the habit. And yet, you know, sometimes when we go out of habit, we are surprised by what happens to us when we're here. And God speaks in unexpected ways. We need the routine. On the other hand, the routine will only survive if, at least from time to time, the heart is in it. I once took tennis lessons when I was an undergraduate. But my heart wasn't in it. I soon gave it up, and I never learnt to do a decent serve. And how many homes in this country, all over the country, are cluttered with musical instruments children wanted to play and started and then lost interest because they found it was difficult. Once upon a time it was the done thing to go to church. Many people went because their neighbours went. They might be looked down on if they didn't turn up. So they went, they sang the hymns, timidly perhaps, not with gusto. They took a turn at reading a lesson, possibly. They sat it out during the sermon, not really listening. And they judged the service by whether it was all over in the hour. But then, as we know, social conventions changed. And it's no longer the expected thing. And so they started to drift away. stay away, stopped altogether. Or maybe they moved house and didn't link up elsewhere. And nowadays I suspect that apart from civic occasions when the mayor and retinue have to turn up, or parade services, or weddings and funerals, the only people who come to church are those who want to. We need the routines, but we also need the heart. And Jesus, in his teaching, calls for a religion of the heart. In murder, in adultery, in all relationships, in prayers, it's the heart that matters. Charles Wesley was right to teach us to pray. Oh, for a heart to praise my God. In his day, cold, formal religion tended to be the norm. He and his brother John taught people to love God from the heart. So this morning we come to meet with God. We come to worship around the Lord's table, to celebrate the love brought to us in the death and resurrection of Jesus. We may have come out of habit, or we may have come out of a longing for God, or both. And so we all join in the prayer, "Come, Holy Spirit, our hearts inspire," so that we may serve God and love others beyond the minimum, and do it from the heart.